This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Silent Victim by Caroline Mitchell, performed by Elizabeth Nolden and Steve West. Benjamin, love you to the moon and back. A gentleman is simply a patient wolf. Lana Turner. Prologue. Emma. 2013. I am not a bad person, but I've done a very bad thing. A sense of unreality washes over me, cushioning the consequences of my act. I am a murderer. My soul is damned to hell. My thoughts are speared by a seagull's cry as it glides across the dusky sky. It is mournful in its bidding, and I stand over the ditch, my knuckles white, gripping the shovel in my right hand. A trickle of sweat rolls down the curve of my back, cooled by the twilight breeze. From the bottom of the ditch, Luke stares with empty eyes, the soil beneath his head absorbing his blood. My lips part to accommodate my heavy breath, while my lungs drive the panicked rise and fall of my chest. Is he truly dead? Did I really kill him? Legs shaking, I cling to the shovel, the only thing keeping me standing in this desolate field. The breeze plays with my hair, blowing dark strands into my eyes and lips. I draw them back behind my ear as I struggle for clarity. Just how long have I been standing here? The cogs of my brain whir, trying to snap back the pieces of the complex edifice that has toppled all around me. My gaze falls to the shovel where his blood still stains the blade. You need to clean that off, a voice inside me whispers. But first, hide the body. My thoughts are cloaked in darkness as self-preservation kicks in. My husband will be wondering where I am. He might even come looking for me. I should check Luke's pulse, call for an ambulance. Deep down, I know it's too late for that now. The ditch is lined with freshly shed leaves from the trees that border the field. A suitable resting place, if only for tonight. Pressing my boot against metal, I slice the shovel into the earth. I draw up a wedge of soil, pausing only for a second before flinging it onto his face. As the dirt hits his parted lips, my stomach rolls over, the gravity of the situation hitting me with the force of a punch. I fall to my knees and vomit noisily into a patch of dandelions. Digging my fingers into the earth, I try to ground myself, coughing and spitting until my throat has cleared. I dare not look at Luke's body as I stand and brush the soil from my jeans. Picking up my shovel, I fling dirt into the ditch until my biceps ache. My armpits are damp with sweat, the skin on my face burning with effort. Opposing thoughts circle my brain like vultures ready to pick over the carcass of my actions. I have committed a mortal sin. Hot tears of regret trail down my face. A thought resurfaces, telling me that I had no choice. Forcing myself to focus, I survey the shallow grave. I can still see flashes of skin, his nose, his brow. Patches of white shirt are visible beneath the soil, and the tips of his leather shoes peep upwards. I stifle a sob. I need to finish this, but my arms are weak and the shovel feels like it is made of lead. Darkness is closing in, yet the sky is devoid of cloud, awaiting the infiltration of stars that will burn brightly long after I am dead and gone. Dropping my gaze to the ground, I try to assemble my thoughts. I will come back tomorrow and finish the job properly. For now, I need to get home. I drag across some fallen branches from a recent gale, throwing them over the ditch until it appears undisturbed. Not that anyone will see it. The only witnesses are the curlews and seagulls flying overhead. I rub my hands against the back of my trousers before tying my shovel to my quad bike. Tomorrow, I whisper, repeating my vow to return. I'll come back tomorrow and bury him properly. The breeze snatches my words as if disbelieving my sincerity. Inhaling deeply, I force my shaking breath back to normality. The land will keep my secret, for now. I mount my quad bike, my eyes on the gravel path home. Revving the throttle, I push everything that has happened deep into the recesses of my mind. Chapter 1. Emma, 2017. Red-nosed and laughing, Jamie ran towards me, his red Wellington boots making a thunk-thunk noise as he scattered the fallen autumn leaves. My husband had a propensity for buying Jamie bigger-sized clothes than he needed, saying he would grow into them. I made a mental note to take our son for a proper fitting. Shaking a tissue from my pocket, I wiped the dribble from his nose. "Swing me, Mummy!" he squealed, his impossibly blue eyes bright with an excitement that only a child could feel. At almost 3.5 years of age, his senses had not yet been dulled by the world. Getting down on one knee, I tightened his blue duffel coat and fixed his gloves before allowing him to run towards the bucket swings. A veil of fog hung over the landscape, leaving the small children's playground too gloomy a prospect for the mothers and their children who frequented it in the summer. I had been coming here since my childhood. I was not going to stop now. The fresh air would serve as a sedative later on, giving me time to catch up with my work. I watched him run towards the swings, his little body wiggling from side to side as layers of clothing hampered his movements. I jolted in response to the hand that touched the curve of my back. "Oh, you gave me a fright," I gasped, clutching my husband by the arm. "And you're very jumpy," he said, his kind face settling my nerves. "I finished work early. Thought I'd give you a lift home rather than have you walking in the fog." I kissed him on the cheek, his smooth skin a novelty. I had been sorry to see his beard go, but the onset of a few grey hairs had been the death knell for his facial hair. In his tailored suit and rich wool-blend coat, he looked every inch the businessman. He was not the only one who made an effort when it came to clothes. I put my contacts in second-hand designer wear to good use, sourcing the vintage style that had appealed to me since my late teens, a look which had caught my husband's eye when we first met. "Just 5 more minutes," I said, turning back to look at Jamie, who was grunting as he tried to hoist his leg into the bucket swing.
"Daddy!"
Jamie squealed, and I watched as Alex swung him around before plopping him into the seat and giving him a hefty push. He was a strong and capable father, but all the same, I found myself biting my lip as my overprotective streak kicked in. Catching my worried glare, Alex brought the swing to a steady pace, despite Jamie's cries to go higher. "I've got some good news," Alex said, giving me a furtive sideways glance. It was enough to tell me that his perception of good news might be different from mine. "You've not gone and bought that car, have you? Diesel engines are pollutants on wheels," I said, my eyes following Jamie as he swung back and forth. Alex could pick his moments, waiting until I was distracted with our son before dropping any bombshells. He knew I would never argue in front of him. "Give over," Alex said, "as if I dare." His Leeds accent filtered through his words. He masked it in the office, changing the rhythm and tone to mimic his upper-class clients. I liked that he could be himself with me. "No, it's about work." I took a sharp intake of breath. The fog was coming down so thick that I could taste it on my tongue. Alex flashed me a smile. "I've been offered the promotion. In Leeds." I finished his sentence, trying hard to hide my reluctance because I could not offer a reason as to why we could not go. At least, not one I could disclose. Yes, he said, giving Jamie one last push. They've given me the job. Opening my arms, I took him in an embrace, but inside, my heart was dropping like a stone. Well done, love. I know how much this means to you. Not just me. He drew away, his dark eyes searching mine. To all of us, living in Leeds is going to be a whole fresh start. You can branch out with your business, and we can enroll Jamie in a private school.
Push, Daddy, push!
Jamie squealed, kicking out with his feet to gain momentum. I fixed the smile that had slid from my face. My reluctance to move had been a bone of contention between us for what felt like a lifetime, all because I was not strong enough to face up to my past. Our house could take forever to sell, I said, clinging on to the hope that our departure would be delayed. That's my second bit of good news, Alex said. I've got someone interested in the property. I should have known. My husband managed the Colchester branch of the estate agency that he worked for. Although he sold mainly upmarket properties, they sometimes had inquiries from buyers with less cash to spare. He hoisted Jamie up from the swing and spoke over his shoulder as he gave him a squeeze. They say it comes in threes. We should buy a lottery ticket on the way home. With Jamie in his left arm, he threw his right one over my shoulder, and the two of us walked to the car. I should have felt safe, protected by his strength, but my mind was racing as news of the move sank in. I strapped Jamie into his car seat, my stomach clenching from the sudden sense of dread. I could not hide from the past any longer. It was time to go back there, to face what I had done.
Chapter 2. Alex. 2017. Beautiful, isn't it? Sweeping a hand across the brooding landscape, I stood at the open back door. My words belied my thoughts. I could not wait to get out of this godforsaken place. I smiled sweetly at Mark and Kirsty, the young couple viewing our home. Not that it had felt like home to me. Despite Emma placing my name on the deeds, I'd felt like an intruder from the day I moved in. It was quaint enough, with its weatherboard exterior and red roof tiles, but the interior needed a serious cash injection and was a poor comparison to the show homes in which I spent my working day. It was hardly any wonder I was too embarrassed to invite my colleagues round. Giving our viewers the full treatment, I glossed over the house's flaws, using the words rustic, quaint, and charming. You can put your stamp on it, I said. Plenty of room for your personalities to shine through. Their nodding heads told me that the tour of our three-bedroom cottage had gone down well. I glanced at my watch, a pang of guilt making itself known. It was the first time I had gone behind my wife's back. I wanted to tell her about the viewing, but she had sabotaged my efforts to move too many times before. Not that she'd ever admit that. I loved Emma with all my heart. Clever, talented, and perpetually enigmatic Emma. Life had never been dull in her company. The puzzling thing was that deep down, I knew she wanted to move. Perhaps it was the guilt of leaving her family home that was holding her back. Then again, her father had died years ago. Whatever the excuse, this place had dug its claws firmly into her and refused to release her. But this time I was ready, and had an answer for every excuse. The viewing couple would not be the first artists drawn to Mercy Island. Mark raved about the network of creeks and boardwalks that crisscrossed the marshes, while his wife delighted in the shapes, textures, and colors of the nearby beach. I nodded in all the right places, attempting to share their enthusiasm. It was all a lie. Where they saw striking abandoned boats on the foreshore, I saw rotting wooden skeletons jutting out of the slime. As they spoke of the Strood, they came up with romantic notions of the island's history. It was something I was all too happy to capitalize on. You can still see evidence of the Roman occupation dotted all over Mercy, I said, having brushed up on the island's history the night before. The ancient causeway connecting the island is the only way on and off. The Strood was something of which I was all too aware. I hated the sense of being trapped as the tide cut us off from the outside world. My father-in-law used to be an archaeologist. He had some fascinating stories. If you're interested, the Mercy Museum is on the west side of the island.
You don't find it a nuisance being cut off by the tide, Mark said.
I shook my head. The locals call it the Causey. It's what makes the island unique. As long as you're up to speed on the tide times, then you should be okay. Perhaps it was because I was a city boy, but settling in Mercy Island was never an option for me. God knows I had tried. It was Emma's idea that we move in to look after Bob, her father, before emphysema claimed his life. I could not stand by and watch him be placed in a nursing home, so I agreed. However, there was nothing to keep us here anymore. I led them round to the kitchen and opened the back door. The gravel drive is wide enough to accommodate several cars if you're holding an event. I pointed beyond the log store and the numerous fruit trees dotted around our half-acre plot. See that gate behind those trees? There's a further 4-acre paddock that comes with the house. You can't see it from here, but there's a wooden bench built into the big oak tree down the end. It would really extend your garden if you took down the back gate and opened the whole lot up.
Now, that would be a big back garden, Mark said,
his nostrils flaring as he inhaled a deep breath.
I love the seclusion. You could run around naked and there'd be nobody here to see it.
Not that we would, Kirsty laughed. We may act like hippies, but I draw the line at bearing all.
I flashed a smile, rubbing my hands together as they spoke. I had a good feeling about this, and knew an offer was on the cards. Impressed by my patter, Mark and Kirsty seemed happy enough to overlook the damp climbing the walls and the crumbling brickwork that needed attention. Their faces gleamed with excitement as I quoted a fair price. My colleagues would have asked for more, but my conscience would not allow it. I reasoned that my lack of ruthlessness afforded me a better reputation than some of the sharks conducting business in my office. My wife was going to turn the land into a giant vegetable patch, but she never got round to it. I looked down at Kirsty's embroidered flat shoes. Do you have any Wellington boots? It's quite foggy, mind. You might be better off coming back when the weather's cleared a bit.
There's no need. I've seen everything on the plans. It's just what we want,
Kirsty said, grinning.
We can drive down there if you prefer,
I suggested for good measure.
There's a laneway leading to the back of the land that's accessible by road. It's a bit bumpy, but we can take my car if you like.
No need, honestly,
Kirsty repeated, turning her gaze to her husband, pleading with her eyes.
We've literally just put it on the market, so I'd advise you not to delay.
I'd barely uttered the words before Mark spoke.
Any movement on price?
I shook my head.
Sorry, we've priced it competitively for a quick sale. I've been offered a job, you see, in Leeds. I can't afford to hang around. I have other people on my books, and it's bound to be snapped up. It's not every day that a property such as this...
We'll take it,
Kirsty breathed, clasping her husband's arm. He rolled his eyes.
So much for playing it cool. Yes, we'd like to offer the full asking price.
I shook their hands in a firm grip.
You've done the right thing. There's so much potential with this property, and it's easily worth the asking price and more. You're getting a bargain.
It's perfect,
Kirsty said, looking around the room as if it were Windsor Castle. Clearly she could see beauty where I could not. I felt comfort in knowing that they were the right buyers. My dislike for Mercy Island was deep-rooted. I had nothing against the residents, and the landscape could be breathtaking at times, but I could not stand the isolation. I could not escape the suffocating sense of claustrophobia when the tide rolled in and the island became closed off from the outside world. At night, fog came like a blanket, so thick you could hardly see your hand. Emma used to laugh as she told me the old story of the ghost that haunted the Strood. I didn't believe in ghosts, but she was voicing my worst fear. Some souls were destined to be here forever, and I did not want to be one of them. In the past, Emma had seemed pleased when I showed her pictures of the properties we could afford. But this morning, as I broke the news in the playground, I could sense her hesitancy. I had a choice. We could delay proceedings by weighing up the pros and cons, or I could carry on full steam ahead. After all, I wasn't just doing this for me. Now that I had the buyers in the palm of my hand, I felt a mixture of relief and excitement. I only hoped that by moving on, my wife could leave the ghosts of her past behind.
Chapter 3, Emma, 2017. "Careful with that," I said to Josh as we unpacked a beautiful silk gown from our delivery. Purchased from Oxfam after being worn just once, it had been a steal. I loved my job and often found that immersing myself in work was the best way of getting through the day. Here, in something borrowed, I could get lost amongst beautiful things and leave the real world behind. I was not the only person to love my shop. Josh did too. My retail assistant was 26 years old, and by his own admission, this was the longest he had ever held a job down. A firm believer in second chances, I had been willing to ignore his mediocre references when I'd offered him the position 6 months ago. Josh might not look like your typical wedding boutique assistant, with his floppy auburn hair and black skinny jeans, but he had proved to be a godsend, setting up the online side of things, as well as helping with the day-to-day running of the shop. "So, have you spoken to your parents yet?" I asked, preferring to focus on his problems rather than my own. He smirked, carefully smoothing the delicate material and giving the dress a little shake. "I work in a wedding shop. I think that's a big enough clue." "We'll get you out of that cupboard yet," I said, smiling as his laughter erupted. "What?" "Closet. It's closet," he said, still chuckling as he carried the dress to the back room to await collection. Under the deal I'd negotiated with the local dry cleaners, all my dresses were picked up and cleaned before going on display. The old-fashioned bell over my door tinkled as Teresa pushed it open with her backside. We were fully staffed today as we prepared to present our winter collection to our clients. "Skinny latte, mocha, and a disgusting green tea for you," said my sister, laying them on the vintage ivory table. "Much obliged," I said, my words barely out before the doorbell rang for a second time. I groaned inwardly. The fact we closed on Mondays never stopped a certain client who had been coming since we opened. Given the nature of our business, we did not see a lot of repeat custom. Maggie was the exception to the rule, and I did not have the heart to refuse her. At 80 years of age and 4'11", she could be swept away by a sudden breeze. She smiled, her bright pink lipstick eclipsed only by the sapphire blue eyeshadow courting her lids. Taking my tea from the table, I patted a chair for her to sit down. The interior of our bridal boutique was like something out of a wedding magazine. I loved the vintage ivory furnishings, the plush cream carpet, and the scent of white roses dotted in antique vases throughout the store. French designer curtains cloaked two generous changing rooms, leading to a platform surrounded by fairy lights and full-length mirrors. Everything fit for a princess on her special day. It was just as I had envisioned it when I'd first met my husband over 9 years ago. Most men would have run a mile from a woman with a passion for wedding dresses. Instead, Alex helped me through my business studies course, encouraging me every step of the way. I felt proud that his faith in me had been rewarded. I never would have made it without his dream big attitude to life. I sat beside Maggie as she stared at it all, her eyes sparkling as they reflected the view. "How are you, lovely? All ready for the big day?" "I came to talk to you about that dress," she said, a frown crossing her face. I'm not sure if it's for me. I heard you have some new ones, and I was hoping to try them on. Really? I thought you looked beautiful. What's changed your mind?
Maggie rifled in her bag, pulling out a bent-up snapshot that I had taken during her last visit. They were laughing at me down the pub, said I was mutton dressed as lamb. Bastards.
Since when have you cared what anyone's thought of you? I asked, seeing wisdom in her green eyes. Now, where are you heading after here? Over to see Bernard?
I crossed my legs, tilting my head to one side as I took in her expression. She gave me a knowing smile.
Already been. He told me to pay no heed.
Makes sense to me. Besides, what do those old codgers down the pub know about wedding dresses?
True, she said, gathering up her bags. I suppose you're right. I should be off. This wedding won't plan itself.
And I'd better get back to work, I said, relieved that today at least she was willing to see sense. Send Bernard my best. It was a spell that Maggie seemed content to stay under. For her, it was preferable to facing the truth. Bernard was not waiting at home. He was in Colchester Cemetery, having died on the eve of their wedding 7 years ago.
You're such a soft touch, Josh said after she had left. For a minute there, I thought you were going to let her try on the new gowns.
80% of our stock was upmarket second-hand, but at the start of each season, I invested some money in the latest designs.
I don't think Teresa's heart would take it, I laughed, knowing that by the end of the session, there would be more makeup on the dresses than on Maggie's face.
I had a special selection of retired and bargain gowns just for her.
She's a good soul, and if it makes her happy, then there's no harm in it, is there?
I could empathize with Maggie. Some people went on living, even those buried in the ground.
Chapter 4, Luke, 2002. I inhaled the smell of freshly mown grass as the school lawn received its last cut of the summer. For me, it marked a new beginning, and as my Year 11 students filtered in through the classroom, I pulled the window shut and offered them a warm smile. "Good morning, class," I said, raising my voice to gain their attention. "My name is Luke Priestwood, and I'm replacing Mr. Piper, who's retired early due to ill health." They seemed surprised but pleased to see me, and I glided over the lie. In reality, Mr. Piper had been pushed. Last year's exam results in art and design had been shamefully poor. According to the head, I had been brought in to inject some fresh blood into the class. That and my indisputable talent had landed me the job. My eyes roamed over the class. At 23, I was freshly qualified and only 7 years older than most of the people in the room. Not that I was intimidated. I watched the male students hitch up their trousers before taking a seat. Arseless and charmless, they paled into insignificance next to me. The chatter in the room quietened, and I gazed down on their expectant faces. Already I could see the effect my presence was having on the female students. My morning gym sessions left me lean and toned, a vast contrast to the pot-bellied Piper, who could barely climb the stairs without coughing up phlegm. I licked my lips as a tinge of satisfaction made itself known. It felt good to be back in the school I'd been taught in. I felt like I'd gotten somewhere in life, that I was in control. I loosened my tie, my eyes roaming over the chattering female students. Sweet 16 and never been kissed. There was little evidence of that here. They were the stereotypical gaggle of teens. Layers of makeup, tight short skirts, and the stink of cheap perfume lacing their skin. Beneath the confines of the school uniform, they held little mystery to me. The shrill ring of the bell jolted me out of my thoughts, signaling it was time for class to begin. I walked to the door, curling my fingers around the handle to push it shut. It met with resistance from the other side, as one last student plowed through. She may have been a poor timekeeper, but my new arrival was deliciously pert, with curves in all the right places. Laden with books, her bag slapped against her thigh when she came to a sudden stop. She briefly met my gaze, and I felt an instant spark of attraction as her cheeks flushed a furious pink. Her dark wavy hair was swept over in a sexy side parting, framing her face. She brushed an errant lock from her cheek, panting from the exertion of rushing to be on time. I regarded her with a look of amused curiosity. Inside, I was thrilled that a gorgeous young creature would be subservient to me for the forthcoming year.
"Sorry, sir,"
she mumbled self-consciously, before finding a table at the back of the room. Tugging at her skirt, she took a seat, entwining her summer-tanned legs. Devoid of makeup and jewelry, she carried an innocent beauty as yet untainted by the modern world. I began the class without a moment's hesitation, explaining my plans for the curriculum. She gave her name as Emma, and I struggled to keep my thoughts in check. She was jailbait, and I was newly qualified. I could not afford to be caught up in an illicit affair. "If you can take out your textbooks," I said, clearing my throat as I tried to focus. But I knew that I was fooling myself. My mind was not on the history of art. It was on the brooding schoolgirl at the back of the room.
Chapter 5, Emma, 2017. My keys rattled as I locked the shop's front door. It had been a long day, and I was dying to get home and kick off my shoes. "I'll see you tomorrow, then." Teresa smiled, her shoulder-length blonde hair catching the last of the dying sun. "No need to detour to the nursery. I'm picking Jamie up today." Teresa was Jamie's godmother. With no other siblings, I had not had many choices when it came to candidates, but there was nobody better suited for the role than my big sister. At 37, she hadn't yet had children of her own and was more than happy to take on babysitting duties. She and Jamie made a fantastic team, and she spoiled him rotten during their time together. "Are you sure?" I said. "It's news to me." Arching one eyebrow, she gave me a conspiratorial smile. "Alex asked me to babysit for a few hours. Looks like he has something in store for you." Alex was an old romantic at heart, and I loved his little spontaneous acts. Even now, after almost a decade, he still had the ability to give me butterflies. After rolling down the shop shutters, I thanked Teresa and left. But as I walked to the car park, my nerves got the better of me. Sure, Alex was no stranger to sweet gestures, but this felt different. Had Teresa misunderstood? Did Alex have something else in store? After paying for my ticket, I entered the Osborne Street multi-story car park. My heels echoed ominously down the hollow concrete construction. Devoid of fresh air, it carried the stale smell of engine oil and diesel fumes that I could not wait to escape. Level C had been full when I'd driven there this morning, but apart from a rusted Mercedes in the far corner, my yellow Volkswagen Beetle now stood alone. A sudden sense of vulnerability sharpened my senses, hastening my steps. I didn't notice the newspaper nestled under my windscreen wiper until I opened the car door. "Odd," I thought, plucking it from its resting place. I was used to seeing flyers, but never a whole newspaper. In the absence of a bin, I threw it onto my front seat, locking myself inside my protective yellow shell. As the car engine rumbled into life and I put the car in gear, I gave the paper another glance. Why had it been placed on my car? Sighing, I threw the gear stick back into neutral while I unfolded the paper, smoothing over the creased pages to reveal the front page headline: "Crash involving three cars causes major delays." I frowned. I didn't remember hearing about that. It was only when I glanced at the date that I froze. 1st of October, 2013. The same date indelibly branded on my mind. The day I killed a man. I exhaled a painful breath, the blood draining from my face. It was a coincidence. It had to be. Maybe it was some kind of promo. Maybe they were on all the cars. My mind raced as it tried to provide me with answers, fuel to enable me to push my fears away. It was someone messing around. It had to be. Only two people knew the significance of that date, and the dead kept their secrets well. I breathed fast and deep, panic rising as the past returned to haunt me. I spun the car round, desperate for the open air. Through my windscreen, I caught sight of the CCTV camera, my glance falling guiltily back to the newspaper on the passenger seat. I could hardly afford to draw attention to myself, not when I had gotten this far. I lowered my window, depositing the newspaper in a litter bin on the way out. It was silly, I told myself, panicking like this over nothing. Just as I always had, I pushed my fears to the back of my mind, focusing on my journey home. I didn't know what to expect when I walked through the front door. I adjusted my eyes to the darkness of our narrow hall, negotiating our uneven terracotta tiling, which was in need of repair. The smell of spicy food wafted from our kitchen, and despite my anxieties, my stomach grumbled in response. "Hey, you, how was your day?" Alex said, looking relaxed in sweatshirt and jeans. His enviably clear skin still glowed from the Indian summer we had enjoyed before the cold autumn winds took hold. Taking my coat, he kissed me on the cheek. I slid my fingers beneath his jumper, and he gasped at the contact of my icy skin. "Sorry," I said, chuckling as I withdrew my hands. "Work was fine. I'm really pleased with the new lines. Well, all except one. It's a beautiful dress, but it's got this whopping big footprint on the train." I did not care about the dress, much less want to talk about it, but he would think something was up if I didn't share my day. "I'm sure you'll work your magic on it," Alex said. He was proud of what I had done to the business, though he had no idea just how lucrative it had become. Had he known, he would have pushed for a move long before now. The thought sent a frisson of worry through me. Had the person interested in the house come through? Was that what this surprise dinner was all about? Alex opened the door to our dining room, and I saw that the table was set. With soft music playing and candles flickering, he had transformed it into a warm, cozy space, but still, there was a chill growing inside me, and I could not hold back the question on my tongue. "What's the special occasion? It must be good. You've bought oysters." "Fresh off the bay," he said, avoiding the question as he poured me a glass of champagne. Oysters were my favorite food, and I rarely went a week without indulging. Jamie called them fish bogies, and Alex wasn't much better, reluctant to admit liking anything that my birthplace produced. I took a few sips from my glass, my nerves jangling as I waited for him to tell me what was going on. We ate in silence, my thoughts racing. It was not until we had finished our desserts that he let me in on the secret. He topped up my glass with the last of the bubbly, and I wondered if he had been hoping for the alcohol to take effect before he broke the news. "Here's to new beginnings," he said, gently clinking his crystal glass against mine. "I've sold the house." My hand raised in midair, I stared at him. "Our house." I lowered my glass, unable to drink its contents. I knew this moment could come, yet hearing the words leave his lips made me feel sick inside. "Yes," he said, his tone forcibly light. "I had a lovely couple view it today. Cash buyers. They want to restore it to its former glory." "Really? But there's so much to be done," I said, amazed he'd accepted their offer without telling me. I should have been annoyed, but I'd made him put his life on hold for long enough. I knew I could not stay here forever. "They're artists. They fell in love with the setting more than anything. They're very keen." My face was a picture of calm, but inside, my heart felt like a jackhammer. Did they check out the land? I said, praying the answer was no. What if they had? Alex said they were artists. People like that would immediately be drawn to the trees that bordered the paddock. What if they discovered my secret? The police could be on their way right now. I might never see Jamie again. No, it was raining, and they didn't have any proper shoes. They offered the full asking price without seeing it. A dream sale. I knocked back the contents of my glass, the once pleasant bubbles now leaving a vinegary taste in my mouth. Looks like we're moving to Leeds, I said, knowing Alex had probably already earmarked a property to buy. You're going to love it, he said, the relief visible on his face as he reached over and squeezed my hand. I offered him a tight smile, my mind on the body I'd buried in our backyard. Chapter 6, Emma, 2017. With Jamie home and tucked up in bed, it felt as if the whole house was sleeping. Alex snored softly, tired from a full day's work, then coming home and cooking as well. I stared up at our low-beamed ceiling, the cobweb magnet, as Alex called it. At 6'2", he had to duck slightly each time he entered a room. Everything was small in our little L-shaped cottage. It was easy to see why he was fed up of it. It was not as if it were filled with happy memories for me either. My mother's departure, nursing my terminally ill father, and what happened out back. It felt entrenched in misfortune. I only hoped that the new owners would have more luck. Alex was quiet and thoughtful when we first met. Our friendship was firmly established before he made his feelings clear. He knew I was still recovering from what I called a bad relationship, although that was as much as I told him at the time. It was the little things that endeared him to me, smuggling food into the library when I was snowed under with studying, and knowing when I needed some time on my own. When I was struck down with a bad case of the flu, it was Alex who nursed me through it. When I was snotty and disheveled, it was Alex who missed important lectures to stay by my side. Alex's continued support was a debt I was only able to begin to repay when his father died from heart failure, squeezing his hand tightly as the man he loved most in the world was lowered into the ground. Alex gave me the courage to believe that I deserved a better life. Family was everything to him, and after we married, all he wanted was to seal our union with a child. Getting pregnant with Jamie had been worth all the sacrifices it took to get there. But now, there was a cloud on the horizon, threatening to break a storm over our happy home. The more I thought about what I'd done, the sicker I felt inside. The truth was rotten and festering. I pictured it as something ragged, dragging itself across the mudflats to make me account for what I had done. Lying in bed, with no streetlights to soften the night, it was easy to allow my imagination to run riot. I had been reckless. Crazy. Christ, I still had the shovel in my shed. Why hadn't I gone back there, buried the body deep, and disposed of the evidence? It was the same reason I stopped going to church after it happened. Because I could not face it. That's why. I forced myself to think about what I had done. Luke's body was out there, but what state was he in? It had been 4 years. Had he fully decomposed, or had the wildlife picked his remains apart? My stomach lurched at the thought. And then a flashback, in glorious detail, making me sit up in bed and gasp for breath. Alex stirred beside me. You all right, love? His words were muffled, thick with sleep. I smoothed his tousled brown hair. I was having a nightmare. I'm going to get a glass of water. You go back to sleep. But as I wrapped my dressing gown around me, I knew the truth was a nightmare from which I could not awake. I crept to the kitchen, working my way through my options, trying to view them as dispassionately as possible. I could return to the body and dig a deeper grave, yes. But what if the new owners had the site excavated? Then what? A chill descended, and I switched on the kitchen light. An energy-saving bulb hung limply from its pendant, devoid of a light shade. The last time I had tried to fit one, it had driven a shock down the length of my arm right down to my toes. Alex seemed happy to allow the place to fall further into disrepair, because it was another reason for us to leave. Shuffling to our wide, square kitchen sink, I filled a glass with water from the tap, forcing myself to focus. I needed a plan B. I could gather up Luke's remains, burn them, dispose of what was left somewhere safe. But how? I was a 30-year-old woman who dealt in wedding dresses. I couldn't do this alone. You murdered him quickly enough, my subconscious rasped. I took a shuddering breath. The idea of going back there made me sick to the core, but I told myself that the man I'd buried had been more of a danger alive than dead. I stared through the window at the moonless sky, comforting myself with the thought that Luke could no longer threaten me. But that was a lie. He was still reaching out from the grave, calling my name. There was no ghost haunting the Strood, just Luke. I had to go back there and deal with the body. Only then could we move away and start again. A new home, a promotion for Alex, and private schooling for Jamie. It was all we had ever wanted, and it was within reach. I just needed to be strong enough to get through this. I sipped my water, not realizing I had bitten my lip until I tasted the warm tang of blood. I remembered the stained shovel, the blood oozing down onto Luke's shirt collar, then into the soil for the insects to feast on. My breath sharpened. I began to think about the meal I had eaten that day and how it was lying in my stomach, working against me. Dark thoughts reached out like tentacles in my mind. I closed my eyes, willing myself to think sensibly. Tomorrow I would go to Colchester, place Jamie into nursery, then ask Teresa to cover so I could finish work early and return home. If Alex found out, I'd say I was checking the fencing before the buyers returned. I'd dig up Luke's remains and dispose of them for good. This time, somewhere nobody would ever find them. Chapter 7, Emma, 2017. The balls of my feet ached from standing in my heels. After a busy morning, I was happy to turn the closed sign on the door for lunch. Not that I was complaining. Being occupied kept my mind off my problems, but I could not exercise avoidance forever. As soon as Teresa came to cover my afternoon shift, I had to go home. Something wrong with that? Josh eyed me from across the circular table as I poked at my salad. It's a bit limp, I said. I should have put it in the fridge. Our staff room was blisteringly warm. It comprised a small table and chairs and a kitchen counter with the usual appliances, microwave, fridge, and sink. It smelled like a greenhouse. Tropical plants took up most of the room, a joking reminder of Teresa's disapproval of the high heating bills. But I couldn't have my brides trying on wedding dresses with goosebumps on their skin. Want some of mine? Josh offered, nodding towards his lunchbox. Mum made loads. No, you're all right. I'm just tired, I said, listlessly prodding some beetroot with my fork. I had a really lucid dream last night, and it's been running around in my head all day. This much was true, though I could not tell him the real reason behind my unease. Was it one of those dreams? I had this dream about Tom Hardy the other night, he said, his blue eyes glinting as he flashed me a cheeky smile. Tom Hardy didn't feature, I replied, wishing I could come clean. The more I came to know Josh, the more I liked him, but there was no way I could burden him with the awful truth. I should have been confiding in Teresa, but I couldn't risk her judgment either. I was in prison, I blurted, feeling my muscles tense. I'd done something terrible, but I didn't know what it was. I woke up crying because Alex wouldn't visit me. I pushed my food away, the thought stealing what little appetite I had. Josh swallowed the bite of cheese sandwich he had been chewing. That's a bit heavy. Where did that come from? I don't know, I said, using the lie to facilitate a conversation I was dying to have. If I didn't speak to someone soon, I would explode. It got me thinking, what would you do if you were married to someone and they did something really bad? To pose such a question to Josh was not out of the ordinary. We were forever discussing moral dilemmas to pass the time when the shop was slow. My heart beat a little faster as I waited for his response. Oh, how bad are we going? Bank robbery? Kidnapping? He rummaged around his lunchbox, plucking out a Mars bar and a bag of crisps. Nobody robs banks anymore. My fingers tapped the table as I pretended to come up with the act that had been on my mind all day. Let's say murder, a one-off, in the heat of the moment. That's tricky, Josh said, his eyes thoughtful as he soaked up the challenge. I guess I'd stand by them, at least until I knew the truth. If I loved them, then I'd like to think I'd stay, because someone I love could never do something like that on purpose. Top marks, I said. Me too. Is this where you confess to murder? A flush rose to my cheeks as he broke the silence with laughter. Can you imagine it? Josh said. You can't even kill a fly. I won't go calling the police any time soon. Now that sister of yours, she's one to watch. He gave me a wink as Teresa strolled in. What have I done now? She said, shrugging off her rain-speckled coat and hanging it on the back of the door. Moral dilemma time. You've married the man of your dreams, but on your wedding night he's confessed to murder, Josh said, embellishing my earlier scenario. The cops are coming to lock his sorry backside up. Do you dump him or hang around? Dump him. Murder is murder. Teresa finger-combed her windswept hair, her words delivered without a moment's hesitation. This is the man of your dreams we're talking about, Josh said. I'd bang him first, Teresa laughed, mulling it over. Maybe stretch to a few conjugal visits? I forced a laugh, the thought of prison continuing to make the prospect of food unappealing. Aren't you eating a lunch? Teresa said, taking a look at my discarded salad. I had a big breakfast, I lied. Really? She narrowed her glare, as if she somehow knew better. But then, she did. Teresa knew many things about me.
Chapter 8, Luke, 2002. I smiled at my own ingenuity as I glanced at Emma, who was sitting on her own in her usual seat at the back of the class. Lunchtime detention was an excellent excuse for having her all to myself. Emma, on the other hand, seemed unimpressed at being kept in for failing to complete her homework. It was the first time it had happened, but it was time to progress things between us, and I could only do that by getting her alone. "Why don't you sit up front so we can chat?" I asked, standing from my desk. A recent haircut, a new set of clothes. I had made a special effort with my appearance in order to reel her in. Not that I knew who or what she found attractive. Everything about her was closed off, hidden from view.
"Yes, sir,"
Emma said, picking up the tin box containing her charcoal pencils. "Well, don't seem so thrilled about it," I smiled, bending down to retrieve a piece of paper that had slipped from her grasp. "Anyone would think you were being sent to the gallows."
"Sorry, sir,"
Emma said dolefully, taking her chair. I leaned forward, grabbing the seat beside her. "What's wrong? It's not like you to miss handing in your homework.
I thought you enjoyed our classes.
I do,
she said, earnestly meeting my gaze.
It's just that...
She pursed her lips, seemingly unsure of herself. Her barely brushed hair, her unironed shirt, her appearance gifted me clues.
Having a tough time at home?
Yes,
she nodded, and I smiled inwardly as I detected a slight wobble in her chin.
You live on Mercy, don't you? Is that the east or the west side of the island?
I asked, hoping the gods would favor me.
The east,
she said glumly.
Nothing around but sky and land.
It was exactly the response I wanted. Had she lived on the west, she could have benefited from the close-knit community that inhabited it. As it was, my little Emma was all on her own. After checking the coast was clear, I briefly rested my hand on her back. You know what they say, a problem shared is a problem halved.
But the homework,
she said, glancing at the half-finished drawing of a drooping sunflower. I removed my hand, marking the paper with my pen.
Consider it done. A plus, your best work yet.
I gave her a wink.
We've got 10 minutes. Why don't you tell me what's wrong?
I wasn't really interested in her pitiful home life, but her physical presence was intoxicating. It was not often I was graced with such innocence in a 15-year-old girl. Her attention drawn inwards, my gaze crept to her skirt, which had risen above her knees. I looked at her face, now twisted with the effort of discussing problems that seemed buried too deep to reach.
Is it your family?
I said, sympathetically tilting my head to one side.
You can trust me. I know what it's like to grow up feeling like you don't fit the mold.
Do you?
She said, a flicker of light reaching her eyes. I'd hit the bullseye first time. Quickly, I formulated a backstory, something that I hoped mirrored her own. I knew she came from a one-parent family and was not part of the popular groups in school.
Yes, I said. I didn't have many friends growing up, and there was nobody I could confide in about what was happening at home. I felt isolated from everyone else because their lives were so different to mine.
Emma nodded sadly.
That's how I feel, too.
I gave her a gentle smile, conscious time was ticking away.
Mum did her best after Dad died, but she couldn't cope with bringing up a family on her own. That's why I had nobody to turn to when...
I paused for effect. It was best to leave these things vague.
Well, none of that matters now. All I'm saying is that you're not alone.
It's why I couldn't do my homework,
she said, her voice low.
Dad wasn't well and I had to call the doctor. Sometimes he finds it hard to breathe. He was meant to write a note, but he was asleep when I left for school, and I didn't want to wake him.
So not only was my little Lolita isolated, she played nursemaid to her father too. Perfect. Such commitment afforded little time for outside friends. The bell rang in the hall to signal the end of lunch.
I tell you what, I said. Why don't you stay behind after school for some extra art tuition? We can have a chat, work out a plan for improving your exam results. You're a talented artist, Emma. If we put in the extra work, your pictures will be fit for the school exhibition this year.
Really?
She said, her face glowing from the compliment.
Mum used to exhibit her drawings. They were hung on the walls of the craft shop in Mercy.
Well, there you go. You've obviously inherited your talents from her.
I smiled. Now, get moving. You don't want to be late for your next lesson. I watched her as she walked away. Her step lightened from the effect of my words. Her desperation would fuel our blossoming friendship. Delicious anticipation beckoned. I had baited the hook.
Now all I had to do was land her. Chapter 9. Alex. 2017.
Congratulations, Alex. We'll be sorry to see you go.